We said Patricia is going to be speaking on step 12, which is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So Patricia, before you get started, the group does have a couple of little tokens of appreciation for you. Got this nice coin here.
Oh, thank you.
And then because of the last few months, if you want to open it, we've been Kevin's peacock, his favorite speaker.
Oh my God.
Come back next week and she'll be a feather duster.
Do I have to turn this over next week? Thank you very much. That's very nice, Kevin. My name is Patricia. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Patricia.
Thank you, Greg. I have to say it's, you know, a little bittersweet that I'm moving on from being Kevin's favorite speaker. I've kind of enjoyed the notoriety of it. It was a long day for me. I had a friend here from, an AA friend from Portland, Maine. You probably have seen her. I've taken her around to meetings. And she wanted to be at the airport at 4:30 this morning. The airport doesn't open until 4:30 in the morning. So, you know, I understand that. You want to be there on time and you're compulsive and all that. So we were there at 4:25 this morning, and then I walked with a friend. I had breakfast at Avante's. I planted in my garden. I had a lot of business calls. Met with a sponsee, and later tonight there's a program on PBS about Lou Tullio. So I'm going to be racing out of here when this is over. So it's been a long day. If I'm a little jumbled, that's why. I kind of divided this into three parts. You know, the step naturally divides itself into three parts. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, carrying the message to other alcoholics, and practice these principles in all our affairs, which for me is the most difficult part. Bill W. had, one kind of spiritual experience. He had the flash of light variety. He was in Towns Hospital, which is a double brownstone on, I believe, the west side of New York City, and he was in there to be detoxed. He was having the belladonna cure, which is 50 hours of belladonna. It's also called the puke and purge. And at that time, it was between $250 and $300 for a five-day length of stay. So, it was only available really to the affluent at that time. But Bill said, I was the recipient of a tremendous mystical experience, or, quote, illumination, end of quote. It was accompanied by a sense of intense white light, by a sudden gift of faith in the goodness of God, and by a profound conviction of his presence. That was not my experience. I was more the Dr. Bob type. And Dr. Bob had what he called spiritual growth. He said, in another way, Dr. Bob's experience differed from Bill's. He never had a flash of light, the spiritual experience. One member recalled that he did not make any mention of this kind of awakening. Rather, it was spiritual growth that Dr. Bob talked about. In AA, he said, his spiritual values changed as time went on. And that was my experience. I believed in God, there was a God, but I had no relationship with God. And it was through the steps, through time, through working with a sponsor, that I developed my own personal relationship with God. And I think for as many people as there are here, there's that many different relationships with God. Bob goes on to say, I think faith can be acquired slowly. It has to be cultivated. I have to think when I look at the steps that my relationship from God came really from 3, 4, 6, 7, 10, 11, and 12 more than anything else. Because each one of those steps really involved an active relationship with God. Bill said that his idea of a spiritual, and you can talk about what's the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening, you know, one is quick, one is slow. But Bill said he was being able to see, do, feel, and believe that which we could not do on our... Guess who didn't turn their phone off? Could not do on our own unaided will alone as evidence of a spiritual experience. And that was me. I could not stop drinking on my own. That was the first evidence. I never even tried to stop. I just knew it wasn't possible. But actually, there was a lot of other things that happened to me as a result of having a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. When I was drinking, I had very few emotions. I had a small range of emotions. I could be angry, I could be sad, and I could be irritable. That was basically it. And it was through AA and through experiences, particularly experiences with sponsor, that I've been able to have other emotions genuinely. I guess maybe numb was another experience that I had when I was drinking. I never had the sense of gratitude until I had a relationship with God. Never, ever. It just wasn't in my repertoire. You will all have your own experience, as I did. The only proviso is that you follow the directions, and the directions are the 12 steps. Some people might say that their spiritual experience comes as a result of attending meetings. And I wouldn't argue with that. I basically wouldn't argue with anybody in AA about anything, but in my experience, people eventually, over time, do develop a relationship with God, with the personal God. The term spiritual awakening and experience are found in the appendix of the Big Book, where it says, the terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading show that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Part two of the step, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics. For me, the word tried is important, because I've failed more times than I've succeeded in trying to carry the message. I wish it were different. I used to, when I was, you know, not an old timer, when I was a young timer, and a sponsee would go out, I would kind of blame myself. You know, I didn't do enough, I didn't say the right thing, whatever. And now I know I'm just not powerful enough to get anybody sober. All I can do is just share what I've got, and if they're ready, they're ready. The Big Book gives us a whole chapter on working with others, on how to do it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just read one paragraph where it says, and you've all heard this, practical experience shows that nothing will do so much to ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. So if you want to stay sober, you work with others. If you want to grow, you work with others. If you want to improve your program, you work with others. This is the reason that I always thank sponsees when they call me, because they are really helping me much more, much, much more than I help them. Bill D., who we talked about before, who was the third guy on the bed, the third guy that got sober in AA, he said, Bill remembers how he was told to go out and carry the message of recovery to someone else. One of the things that really touched him was hearing Bill W. tell Mrs. D. about a week later, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling people. So, you know, I'd love to say that everybody gets sober, but we all know that isn't the case. There was a nun that worked with Dr. Bob, Sister Ignatia. You've probably heard about her. She was at, they had an 8-bed ward at St. Thomas Hospital. And at that time, they put, Dr. Bob made arrangements for the alcoholics to go in a private room so that people could come and speak to them. Sister Ignatia was, she was a sister of charity, I think, who was born in Ireland. And she used to give drunks, when they were being discharged, a little badge of the Sacred Heart. And she used to say, "Before you drink, return that badge to me." At that, and she's now being up for canonization, which I think is interesting. I think that started in 2016. So there's somebody we can pray to if we need a miracle. Some hospitals at that time just wouldn't admit alcoholics because they felt they were hopeless. And so what Dr. Bob did is he admitted them with the diagnosis of gastritis so that the hospital would take them. I really believe that we alcoholics are the ideal person to help another alcoholic, more than psychiatrists or psychologists or the family. My own experience was that I was in rehab and I was there probably just short of a week. And it was another alcoholic, a woman, a little younger than me, that called me on it, asked me how much I drank, and I honestly told her. And she said, without any drama, just deadpanned, she said, "You're an alcoholic." And hearing that from another alcoholic who had no axe to grind, nothing, you know, that broke in on my denial a lot. We have a saying in my group that, you know, one drunk talks to another, one drunk dumps on another, and they both get better. And I was trying to count the other day the number of people I've sponsored over the years and what's happened to them, and I can't really remember everything, but I can say for 100% sure that a half of them did not get sober, and that's really scary. And, you know, I don't think I was the weak chain in their link. I think they just weren't ready. I do 100% of the time feel better when I interact with another alcoholic, even if it's just bumping into somebody at the gas station or anywhere. I did early on, though, have to get balanced. Somewhere between 10 and, say, 20 years, I was sponsoring too many people and doing too much service. And I hate to almost raise this, but that was the case. And my family was really suffering. And so I had to talk to my sponsor, and we kind of agreed that I wouldn't take any more sponsees, and as people moved along, you know, I would keep just a certain number. And I also realized that my ego was getting into play, you know, and I had to face that. Right now I have like 6 old-timers and 1 new-timer, and that's about a pretty good balance for me. So when do we carry the message? Well, we carry it basically the first day we come into these rooms. I always tell sponsees, the first thing you can do when you come in is go up and thank the speaker. You know, that takes nothing to do that. But it's just basically, you know, politeness, makes the speaker feel good, and, you know, it's no big deal. It's a simple thing to do. So shake the speaker's hand and thank them. You don't all have to do that tonight because I'm leaving early. I have to see that PBS show if it kills me tonight. I also tell newcomers to give their number to somebody that's newer than them, even if it's only by a day, because a newcomer can relate more easily with somebody who's new than, you know, some old turkey like me. And everybody puts out books and picks up chairs. I think we need old comers as well as newcomers at the meeting. That's very important. I know from my personal viewpoint, I need to see old-timers here just as much as I do new-timers. Contributing to the seventh tradition, if you're able, is, you know, part of carrying the message. It's interesting, in New York, in my group, we've just gone from $1 to $2. But in Europe, 15 years ago, they were at 2 euros, which is right now, the dollar's at 0.92. When the euro is at 0.92 a dollar, so what is that? You can calculate. Anyhow, it's twice what we did in New York. When I try to sponsor, I try to do it by sharing what happened to me. Even if my experiences are not exactly like somebody else's, I think that's a little better than trying to, you know, quote the big book or, you know. And I fall into the trap that being a college professor, my fallback position, my DNA is to lecture. And so I'm constantly have to fight that and tell myself, you know, I just need to share my own experience. That's it. When I look for a sponsor myself, I look for somebody who goes to a lot of meetings, is a member of my group, and who does service. Those are my three criteria. The question always arises, you won't have to ask this, when should you sponsor? I say if you're in doubt, ask your own sponsor. But my feeling is once you've got a good start on step 9, you know, and everything before step 9, you're ready to sponsor. I started sponsoring after I finished the 12 steps, which was about a year. The question, how do you sponsor? Well, I like to have a sponsor be in the same group as I am so that I can put, you know, eyeballs on them regularly. And it's the 90-90, 90 meetings in 90 days. And I like to see some of those being big book and step meetings every week. You know, I think discussion groups are great. I have nothing against discussion groups. Unfortunately, sometimes they settle into the problem rather than the solution. And, you know, newcomers don't want to hear the problem. They come with their own problems. If all they hear is problems, what's the point of AA? So I always look a little bit askance at some discussion meetings. And, you know, service is primordial, as the big book uses that word. In my group in New York, you can't chair till you have a year. And that's by group conscience. And one of the other things we do is we have a way of, instead of asking people to speak, we, a representative of each group meets in a parking lot of a church in the central part of the county about 5 o'clock one Sunday morning. And we come with papers with our group's address and the day of our meetings. And we exchange with other groups. So for example, I'll go and I'll come back with 12 pieces of paper from other groups where they need speakers, and then I've given my papers for my group to the other groups. So that way we get speakers coming in from all over the county. And then I go back to the group and I post them and people sign up for which ones they want. And it works very well. So when I have a sponsee, I usually sign up for one of those to go what we call an outgoing. And then the next month, I take the sponsee and let her give her first lead. So that's at 6 months. I've made a lot of mistakes, really, sponsoring people. There was a young man in Erie who for years I tried to help. He had gotten so many DUIs, he wasn't allowed to drive. And so I would take him to meetings. I would try to find meetings where other people could take him. He graduated from prep, so I found him a sponsor who was graduated from prep. I had him do work around my house. I gave him to other people. And all I would get was him calling me drunk. And I'd have to say, you know, I'm talking to the drink, I'm not talking to the alcoholic, and hang up. And I don't know where he is today, but I continue to pray for him. I told you a little bit in previous sessions here about my first sponsor, Glenda. So I won't mention her again. But my second sponsor was a woman who had one son, and she found him dead in the woods behind her house of alcoholism. And I had one son, and as a mother, that was my greatest fear. And when I saw how she handled that with the rooms, I said, that woman could be my sponsor. And then she eventually moved, and so I had to get another sponsor. and I got a sponsor whose name was Nancy, and I had her for a long, long time. Her story was similar to mine. She never hung up the phone that she didn't say, "I love you." And that was not the kind of family I came from, but that's what I was able to learn and do as a result of hearing this person over and over again. And she eventually got pancreatic cancer. She was in the hospital dying, and I was out of the country. I came home, and I went right from JFK Airport right to her hospital. And her husband, who had been there around the clock, he said, "Would you mind if I went home and got a shower, and could you stay?" And I said, "Of course." And so I stayed with her, and she was comatose. But I just sat by her bed and held her hand. And when I was ready to leave, I said, "Nancy, do you want to say the Serenity Prayer?" And so I said it, and she moved her mouth to it, but she was unconscious. And, you know, she passed that night. But she was a great sponsor who, you know, every sponsor I've had has been great. My last sponsor, Lake, is my current sponsor. And we have a thing in New York. If somebody is sick, even temporarily or long-term, and I'm speaking for women now, we will get four or five women and take meetings to their house, you know. And she and I went to take a meeting to a woman in the Bronx who was dying of cancer. And she was like, you know, horribly swollen. And it was just, it was very hard. And when I came out with my sponsor and we went to get in the car, I said, "I can't go back." And she said, "You can and you will." And that's how she faces life, and I've learned that from her. You can and you will. I mentioned before she has, my sponsor has metastatic cancer right now, and when it's anniversary, she's the one that brings the cake every month, month after month, and she bakes it herself. I mean, she's really a wonderful example of service. I learned early on that if you're going to change sponsors for any reason, that you pray about it. And that's what I've done each time. I've prayed for God to put the right sponsor in my life. And he hasn't disappointed me yet. The house that I grew up in when I was a kid, I had a very critical mother. And so I grew up a very critical person. And I always have this harsh, punitive voice in my head, you know, that's talking to me. And so one of the things I've tried very, very hard to do is to avoid any kind of criticism with a sponsee or a newcomer. Because I think as alcoholics, we're like so beaten down and we come here so low. And the last thing we need is anybody, you know, criticizing us. So I give a really hard pass to newcomers. I do think, though, there's a difference between criticizing somebody and telling the truth. And if you want to know the truth, you can ask me because you're going to get it. I think, you know, we're saving lives here. Not to be too dramatic about it, but we're really saving lives. And I don't think we can afford to just pat somebody in the head and say, "Oh, dear, dear, thank you. You're okay," you know. And I've always chosen a sponsor who tells me the truth. That's so important for me. Service. I think I've held practically all the jobs in AA in my time. When I came in, we talked about the ABCs of sobriety. That was ashtrays, butts, and coffee cups. That tells you how long I've been around because we don't have ashtrays and butts anymore. When I was newly sober for the first 6 years of my sobriety, I was in the Army Reserves, and I would drill every month at the Bronx VA Hospital. The Bronx VA Hospital is, you know, the place of last resort, particularly for alcoholics. It's where the traditional vision that you have of people under the bridge, you know, go. These guys are guys that are really, they've been through many, many, many times, and they're heavily medicated. And anyhow, I would go with two guys. I was there for my Army Reserve duty, so I was in my uniform, which made me always very uncomfortable. But I would go with two guys, and we would have a meeting at, I don't remember whether it was 1 or 1:30, and these two guys were really supposed to do it, lead and chair, but sometimes one of them wouldn't show up, so I would do whatever was needed. And one time, neither of them showed up. So I went all by myself to the room, and as I said, I was really uncomfortable because I was in my uniform, and I just prayed, "Dear God, let me help somebody." So I gave my, you know, my regular lead, and everybody just sat there, you know, like, and looked at me. And the time was up, and, you know, there was, finally I said, "Does anybody have any questions?" And one little old gentleman, you know, in the slippers, you know, the styrofoam slippers and the blue and white striped bathrobe and the gown, he raised his hand and he said, "I think I finally figured out what's wrong with me." And I thought, "Oh God, I helped somebody." And he said, "My wife is an alcoholic." So, yeah, but I stayed sober. We're very fortunate to spend every summer in France for 40 years. And there was a little meeting that I had been going to. The place where we are is it's a little fishing village of 1,800 people. And the nearest AA meeting is once a week in a town of 40,000 people. And it's through the fields, you know, through the artichoke fields and the, you know, the farmland. And I used to hate going to that meeting, because it was the same six or eight guys. They never started on time. They never ended on time. It was a free-for-all. You know, you could double dip, triple dip. You could bring your neighbor if you wanted to. The acoustics in the room were terrible. My French was really bad. They said I spoke French like a Spanish cow. The worst thing was, they didn't make the coffee till after the meeting was completely done, which was like 10:30. And then they only had these little cups, and they were all like regular coffee, no milk, no creamer, no sugar. And I mean, who could drink? I couldn't drink that at 10 o'clock at night. Anyhow, one time they said, and every week they'd say, "Okay, who wants to do the meeting next week?" And somebody would volunteer. And how it went is, one person would do all the readings, would open the building, would make the coffee, would pick the topic, would talk about the topic, and would lead the whole meeting. So one person did everything. So they asked me if I would, one time I was very pleased. They said, Patricia, would you do it next week? So I said, "Oh, sure." I was, you know, very proud. I got all the readings in French. I went home. I practiced them all week. You know, notre méthode, how it works. My husband, who spoke French perfectly, corrected my French day after day, so I got it down. And then I decided that I was going to show them how New York does a meeting. So I started on time. I got a silver tray. I polished it. I put one of those white doilies on it. I brought fresh pastries. The coffee was made. I brought decaf coffee. I bought a second coffee pot. I bought creamer. I bought sugar. I did the whole nine yards. Did the whole meeting, and I was sweating because my French was so bad. They never asked me to do it again. Oh my God. But anyhow, I was at my home group in Larchmont complaining about this meeting, you know, how it was, you know, you had to drive in a standard shift up a hill, and, you know, it never started on time, the whole thing. And some woman who wasn't even a member of our group grabbed me afterwards and she said, "You have it wrong, honey. You're not going to that meeting for yourself. You're going for somebody else." And it was like you could have whopped me up the side of the head. I always thought I was going to meetings so I didn't drink. But really, you know, we go also for other people. So that was a powerful lesson for me. My name is on a list for English-speaking people in that region of France. If anybody comes and needs a meeting, you know, I get a call or email. When my husband died in November, my son and I had decided we were going to skip Christmas this year. And so Intergroup in New York needed people to answer the phone. So I took a two-hour block every day for the week of Christmas. And anybody can do that here if you want to. They just will forward the calls to you. There's two people on, and you know, they forward the calls to your cell phone or your house phone. And, you know, of course, I had big ego. I thought I was going to save all these alcoholics. All you get is calls like, you know, can you tell me where there's a meeting on East 34th Street? And then, oh, I don't like that meeting. Can you give me something else? You know, so those are the calls you get. But anyhow, I felt like I was doing something rather than just feeling miserable because my husband had just died. I remember about 2 or 3 years ago, I came to this meeting, and it was the middle of winter, and it was dark, and it was really a snowy day. I mean, the road was horrible. The snow plows had not been down it. And instead of having a sign on the door that the meeting is canceled because of snow, Kevin was out there in his car waiting for each person to come to personally tell them, do you remember that, Kevin? That the meeting was canceled. And I thought that was pretty darn good. That was service. Let me do it on time. On the topic of sharing, sharing is, you know, another way, sharing honestly what's in your heart, of doing the 12th step, you know, whether you share at a meeting or with a sponsor or with a senior member of AA. My first sponsor used to say, never leave a meeting if something's on your mind. Either say it or grab somebody, but never leave the meeting. If you're at a discussion meeting and you don't know what to say, just talk about what's bothering you. I remember one Christmas day, I was at a meeting, and I was really frosted at my husband for something. I can't even tell you what it was at this point. But I was ready to throw him out. And I was at the meeting, and my stomach was in knots. And I was like, and I was walking out of the meeting, and one of the members of our group was a former fire chief in town. His name was Dave. And he must have seen something on my face. And Dave said, how are you, Patricia? And I pinned him against the wall, and I gave him chapter and verse on everything, you know, why I was going to throw this bum out. And he listened, and he listened, and he listened, and he said, did you call your sponsor? Oh. And I said, no. And, you know, that's how we get help. What I have to fight is the feeling that because I have time, it's embarrassing to talk about, you know, the character defect du jour. And that's not healthy, you know, because for me, I still have resentment, fear, you know, all of that. And it's just ego that gets in the way if it says, oh, you know, at 34 years, you shouldn't be feeling that. Well, that's not true, you know. Let's see. Some of the benefits of sharing: you get a new perspective, you stay accountable to the group, you avoid relapse, you develop new friendships, like Dave the fireman, and it's a type of service. Okay, so the last part of the step, practice these principles in all our affairs, and I also want to say that that could also be called we are not a glum lot. Which is, I love that phrase. Like I said, I still suffer from resentments, dishonesty, fear, so, you know, I need to keep right on these principles. The good old timers, and Dr. Bob talked about before we really had the steps, and he says, and he's talking early on now, at the core of the program were the four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity, and absolute love. And Dr. Bob said these are the only yardsticks AA had in the early days before the 12 steps. So those were the principles early on before we got the steps. I love my sponsors, and this is one of the, another one of the things that attracted me to her. Her constant refrain is courtesy, kindness, justice, and love. Courtesy, kindness, justice, and love. And that those are powerful principles for me, and all of them that I need to really keep top of my mind. She even, on her Christmas card this year, had that printed as her Christmas message. Earl Hightower, have anybody heard of Earl Hightower? Yeah. He said, a code of love and tolerance as a core principle in my life could guide me to a life beyond my imagination. So, you know, the four absolutes, courtesy, kindness, justice, and love. And if you read chapter 5, how it works, which we also read at a lot of meetings, you know, honesty and rigorous honesty is mentioned, I think, 5 times. So that's another principle. So for me, my primary purpose is to stay sober, help other alcoholics, and to become happy. In the 12 and 12, though, it says something about life handing us big lumps. Then perhaps life, as it has a way of doing, suddenly hands us a great big lump that we can't begin to swallow, let alone digest. And that gives examples of it. But it says, have we alcoholics got, or can we get, the resources to meet these calamities which come to so many? Well, you know, there isn't a person here who hasn't had a big lump in this room. I know I've had my share. You know, my dad died when I was in the rooms. I've been hospitalized for cardiac issues 10 times and shocked 4 times. And my husband died. That was probably my biggest lump last November. But I have to tell you, the very first 2 calls I made when I got the call that he had died was to people in AA. The first one was to my sponsor, and the second one was to somebody else. And if you've ever had a close loved one die, you know at the funeral home, it's just a blur, you know. You stand there and people parade past, and you don't remember who they were, what you said. You don't remember anything. You're just like in a state of shock. And I remember at one point looking up in the funeral home, and around me were 4 sponsees, just standing there like soldiers, you know, not saying anything, just there to support. And then I looked across the room. It was a long room, and my son was standing at the other end of the room, and standing next to him, just quietly, silently, was another one of my sponsees. And I said, that's what AA is, you know, and that's how I got through it. I have prayed every day since then to know what the will of God is for me and to help me keep going. I have to tell you, though, I have no fear, absolutely no fear about the future. And even though, you know, I lost somebody who was, you know, the 44-year love of my life, I'm happy most days. I really am. I signed up this September to volunteer at the Bill Wilson House for a week in Vermont, which is another opportunity for service. If you've never done that, that's a good thing too. I'm trying to speed up here because I want to save time for questions. But for me, the grocery store, being in the grocery store is an example of how well I'm working the steps. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, the first thing is, as I'm driving to the grocery store, if somebody puts their turn signal on, I let them in. Okay, I don't have a bumper sticker that says honk if you like Bill. I'm not that good yet. But I do let people in. The grocery store in Larchmont, where I'm from, they have a coffee bar where you can go and get a cup of coffee and you pay for it at the bakery and then you drink it when you're going around the store. And I would always get a small cup of coffee. And then I would go down one aisle, and I'd come down another aisle, and I'd finish the coffee. So I'd go and top it up. But you see, I only paid for a small cup. And then I'd go around another aisle, and I'd go back, and I'd top it up. And I called my sponsor, and I said, I don't feel good about this. And she said, why don't you buy a bigger cup? And it just didn't dawn on me, you know? It just didn't dawn on me. So the coffee was step 10. When I leave the grocery store, I put my shopping cart back where it belongs. Even if it's raining, and even if I just got my hair done. Because that's the principles, you know, doing the right thing. I don't avoid people in aisles. You know, I did step 8 and 9, so I don't have to wonder who's coming around the aisle before or after me. I try not to either overshop or obsess about the price, which is step 2, restored to sanity. And I basically try to mind my own business. My first sponsor taught me that if somebody, you know, either in or out of AA, comes with like this big drama, blah, 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 her response always was, that's an interesting problem. How are you going to handle it? Rather than what would have been my MO was jump in, make the drama bigger, tell her what to do, you know. So I've memorized that phrase. That's an interesting problem. How are you going to handle that? And it works. Let's see. Okay. Let me end with just one thing here. And that's a pamphlet, which probably Kevin will be getting this now. You don't have this one here. It's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a pamphlet that was written by a healthcare professional to explain alcoholism to other people. And I particularly like the last, it's not long, it's like 30 pages, one of the last pages. It says, at church, it is read a portion of the Gospel of John, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say, art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only poor in material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel quite literally meant the good news. So 34 years ago, I left rehab. At 9 in the morning, I went home, I took a shower. I was at the 12 noon big book meeting at St. John's Church in Larchmont, New York. And if you were to ask me today, Patricia, tell us, what did you find? I would say to you now, I can tell you only what I have heard and what I have seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them, and that the word of the gospel meant quite literally the good news. My name's Patricia. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Patricia.
3 minutes.
Do we have any questions for our speaker?
No, we won't.
Any questions?
All right, we'll ask a question. Just so we can get one. Yeah, exactly. Gretchen alcoholic.
As
Jeff said, this is my service work. Speaking of, I need to talk to you about service after, well, I know you're in a hurry, but so anyhow, I was at a conference not all that long ago, and they were talking about the principles. And the speaker shared that, you know, how we have the one word principle with each of the steps. His experience was that there's, that the principles go beyond one word. It's the action of that word. So can you share how you understand that to be? Do you associate the principle to just one word or the action of it?
I have to say the action. And I did, you know, I did for my own edification do that. Write down, I don't know where it is now. Write down one word for each step. Actually, it's not exactly one. It's a few more than one. But I really think they're all action. They're all action verbs, each and every one of them. I don't see how they could be any different, really. 1 minute.
Thank you.
I'm not really a humorous speaker. I don't know why everybody keeps laughing.
Hey, Eric, alcoholic. Last question. Actually, I just wanted to say thank you for sharing. I learned something every week from you. And I think everybody else really appreciates everything you did.
Yeah.
I do have a question. Will you be flipping at commercials to the NFL draft, or are you just going to watch it?
That's right. That's on tonight, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm watching Tulio on PBS, okay. 8 to 8:30.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you. You're welcome.